This program is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Network, a world leader in talk radio since 1998. Visit GCNlive.com today.
You can stick it to the man and big tech. Join our FTL social mastodon at social.freetalklive.com. Free Talk Live.
We return at Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. You can find Liberty Conspiracy Live every Monday through Friday on Rockfin, Rumble, and my Twitter /XV. That's at Gard Goldsmith, G-A-R-D Goldsmith. And please feel free to check out the Gardner Goldsmith Substack, where you'll find lots of news and information, the Sunday News Assembly with 20 stories pertaining to Liberty, at least 20, plus video links, and of course, contextual information to help unwrap those onions of politics and get to the roots of things. And here in this segment, I want to continue with our conversation looking into the oral arguments about the Murthy v. Missouri Supreme Court case. And in this case, we're investigating some of the context from decades ago about what might have been a precedent where the state of Rhode Island tried to stop certain books being published by Bantam Books within the state of Rhode Island. That was part of the discussion inside the Supreme Court. It's a minor part, but it is interesting and it is kind of important to check out before we get into some of the crazy statements from some of the Supreme Court justices and other statements that actually might comport a little bit more to their oaths to their Constitution. We'll check it all out and look at deeper lessons of freedom right here on Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. Thanks for listening, everyone. They say part of the commission's responsibility in this state was to, quote, educate the public concerning any book or other thing containing obscene, indecent, or impure language. So are they just informing? Are they targeting? Right? The commission carried out this responsibility by threatening the distributors of material deemed to be objectionable with prosecution in an attempt to suppress obscene material. In its fact-finding capacity, the trial court found the commission's attempted suppression to have been successful, and of course, you can't do that. So, the federal government, under their argument, does not want to be seen as falling under the Bantam Book standard, because that clearly showed that the state was involved in trying to shut somebody down. But they didn't go into the deeper question. And that's something that, in fact, they didn't need to do under these oral arguments, because there are prima facie examples of the government literally paying Twitter and threatening, as I mentioned, antitrust against Facebook and others. But even if you remove that from the argument, the deeper philosophical point and economic point is that when you take somebody's money, even to put out a message that this other person's statement is dangerous and wrong, even if you're not engaging in legal action to stop that person, you're engaging in coercive force to take somebody's money to put out that message. As Thomas Jefferson said, that is immoral. The use of force to promote a message that runs counter to the morals of someone who's had his money taken is completely unjust and needs to be stood against. So the book publishers argued that the actions of the commission were an act of government censorship that failed to provide safeguards for protected speech. The state of Rhode Island... Oh, I thought it was in New York. Oh, yeah, okay. It was the publishing company was based in New York, but they were going up against the state of Rhode Island. That's what it was. State of Rhode Island argued that the commission lacked the power to suppress obscenity because its power was, quote, limited to informal sanctions. The state also argued that the actions of the commission were not actions of the state and, as such, did not fall within the scope of the 14th Amendment. The trial court agreed with the book publishers and granted the injunction against the commission, holding its actions unconstitutional. The Rhode Island Supreme Court, however, reversed the decision of the trial court And the Supreme Court ended up agreeing with the publishers. As you can see on the screen, the U.S. Supreme Court voted 8-1 to reverse the decision of the Rhode Island Superior Court, but only six justices signed on to the majority opinion written by Justice William J. Brennan. And Hugo Black and Tom Clark concurred. In the majority's opinion, Justice Brennan addressed the arguments made by Rhode Island, writing that through its use of threats of prosecution, you got Joe Biden right there. But again, you don't even need those parallels. The commission engaged in actions that amounted to informal censorship. Look at Section 230. Always the threat hiding back there, and Alito was on top of that. Furthermore, these actions constituted acts of the state under the 14th Amendment because the commission operated under the color of state law. Brennan then addressed the arguments made by the book publishers and found them to have merit. He wrote that although the court's decision in a previous case in 1957 held that obscenity was not protected by the First Amendment, state regulations must contain certain procedural safeguards. These safeguards require, quote, that regulation by the states of obscenity conforms to procedures that will ensure against the curtailment of constitutionally protected expression. So in other words, these people were not afforded due process. Okay. And, of course, if they were going to shut down these people and somehow that were seen as legal, that also would breach the Fifth, Sixth, and Eighth Amendments. Because you have the promise of due process, you have a trial by jury, and you can't punish someone and take stuff from someone without an actual trial. So that's what a taking is. So let's go back now with that background. You got that on that book decision. I'm going to go back. Here we go.
We'll hear argument first this morning in case 23411, Murphy versus Missouri. Mr. Fletcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The government may not use coercive threats to suppress speech, but it is entitled to speak for itself by informing, persuading, or criticizing private speakers. Like Bantam Books, this case should be about that fundamental distinction between persuasion and coercion. But unlike Bantam and the case that you'll hear next, this is not a typical suit where a speaker challenges government actions affecting its own speech. Instead, two states and five individuals are trying to use the Article III courts to audit all of the executive branch's communications with and about social media platforms. That problem has infected every step of this case. Respondents don't have standing at all because they have not shown an imminent threat that the government will cause a platform to moderate their posts in particular. But the lower court still reviewed a vast range of speech by different officials to different platforms about different topics at different times without asking whether it had anything to do with respondents. And the courts then entered a universal injunction restricting speech about any content posted on any platform by anyone and binding thousands of officials, including presidential advisors speaking to the public and FBI agents trying to protect the nation from foreign threats.
Okay, let's stop it right there, everybody, because the protection from foreign threats thing, that goes into the Portman Murphy stuff. I've talked a lot about that. But one of the key things I want to discuss here is how he mentions that these people in particular don't have standing because they can't say that they personally were cited. And this is a very interesting, they're not going to get out of this. It's a very interesting philosophical reversal. Because in this case, they constantly tell us this canard of public health. So they remove the individual for the gestalt, for the consequentialist idea. And, of course, the underlying threat is always one individual can be sacrificed for the greater so-called good, which, as I've mentioned, if you're in a logic class, means that everybody who comprises the so-called greater good is potentially a target. Therefore, it actually undermines the well-being or so-called general welfare of the greater good for all those people. Because every time you target someone, if you remove that person, there's going to be another person targeted in perpetuity. That's the way the state operates, okay? So there's no such thing as general welfare. There's no such thing as public health because everybody actually is put in danger of having his rights destroyed for the so-called group, right? But what's curious here is Brian Fletcher, the principal deputy solicitor general, says that it must, that he tries to particularize it, right? He's trying to say, well, these people who are plaintiffs in particular, they can't claim that they were personally cited. It was a widespread non-citing of people where they came up with policies and algorithms and things like that, and they went after those things. Now, first of all, that's not true, because literally the government had a backdoor on Facebook and on Twitter to remove specific, and they insisted, when are you going to get rid of this? When are you going to get rid of this over at Twitter? We saw Matt Taibbi's reporting on it. But even if that weren't the case, okay, what is really interesting logically and philosophically here is that the argument that they give about how the general will protect everybody is also now being used to say, you individual who were hurt, we must see particularization, and we don't see it on the government's argument side. You have to be a particular victim, and we're not seeing particularization here. It was only done to the general public. So literally what they're saying here is the exact opposite of what they argue for the so-called public health argument. They're saying, well, we were just threatening everybody. But now you see how there's never a connection for these people. They're always going to use some way to get out of this. So what they say here is it was only for the general people. There was never an individual cited, right? And so therefore, because there was no individual cited and it was only for the group, you have to be able to cite that individual who was hurt. But of course, they're saying we were threatening everybody. They're admitting they were threatening everybody. That's the point, right? If you didn't conform with that line, then you were part of that group. So that runs counter to their we're protecting the group argument. Now they're arguing, well, we were threatening the group. But the individual, again, is not part of the group. And it's insane. It's absolutely crazy. You see what I'm saying, right? It's totally stupid. You could draw it out on a logic tree on a board. It's absolutely insane. I don't know how this guy got through law school. It's amazing.
Even apart from the Article 3 problem, that injunction rests on two fundamental legal errors. First, the Fifth Circuit radically expanded the state action doctrine by holding that even concededly non-coercive communications, like the CDC's public health advice, can transform private platforms' editorial choices into state action. And second, the Fifth Circuit mistook persuasion for coercion. It held that the FBI's communications are inherently coercive because the FBI is a law enforcement agency, a theory that even respondents don't defend in this court. And it held that White House officials engaged in coercion because they used strong language or referred in a general way to legal reforms in response to press questions. If this court reaches the merits, it should reaffirm that government speech crosses the line into coercion only if, viewed objectively, it conveys a threat of adverse government action. And because...
Okay, so right there, what's the first thing that pops into your head if you have any, if you're at all cognizant of Section 230? The threat of public action. Because behind all of this is Section 230, which, as I mentioned in the video, promises online platforms and ISPs that they will be immune from state prosecution and from personal liability suits for defamation as long as the government, the federal government, deems that they are curating or moderating the content on their ISPs or their social media sites according to the good faith as defined by the feds. So that's always what I've been talking about this for like 3 years now. That's 4 years. That's always what was at the heart of this coercion, was that monster hiding behind the curtain. Guess what? We're going to let King Kong loose. We're going to let those chains off. It's going to go rampaging through New York City. If you don't do what we're telling you, we're going to have all those things removed because they decide. So this guy, he clearly doesn't understand what coercion and compulsion actually are. The threat was always there.
The threats happened here. The court should reverse. I welcome the court's questions.
Mr. Fletcher, is the coercion encouragement framework out of Brandon Book the only way to look at the this case.
Okay, so we're looking at that. That's Clarence Thomas, if you're just listening, is asking, is the coercion framework the only way to look at this case from the Bantam side of things?
So I think there are two ways to look at this case. I think one of them is the coercion inquiry, which we think comes from Bantam Books. You can think of that as an aspect of state action, because when private parties are compelled to act, as the court said in Halleck, they become state actors. We think that's the right way to think about this case.
What is actually the right way to think about this case if you're a constitutionalist? And again, I'm a voluntarist, so I would go a heck of a lot farther. First Amendment, strict wording. Congress shall make no law. States, different matter. Then you're done. Let's continue.
Courts have also proposed a different way, the state action way. They suggested that even absent coercion, the government speech, if it encourages, in some colloquial sense, private action, it can turn that private action into state action.
So I understand your argument, do we normally apply state action doctrine in cases involving the government or private parties?
Both, I think. In some state action cases, you're asking someone is suing a private party and alleging that private party is bound by the contours of the First Amendment or other constitutional provisions because they're state actors. You see some suits like that look like this, suits against the platforms, suits against Stanford University, which is referenced in Tamika's brief here. But you also see suits against the government based on conduct by private parties. That was the case in Blum, and that's the theory that respondents are pursuing.
Are there any First Amendment cases?
Any First Amendment cases? I'm sorry.
Employing state action doctrine.
And suing the government. Off the top of my head, I can't think of one.
So they're usually things like Medicare or government contracts or relationships like that.
Yeah, and I think what that gets at is that it's very unusual, and we don't think it's possible for the government through speech alone to transform private speakers into state actors. We think these cases usually are and ought to be viewed through the Bantam Books type framework, where there's a problem if the government is engaged in coercion, but if it stays on the persuasion side of the line and all we're talking about is government speech, then there's no state action and there's also no First Amendment problem.
One final question. You continue to refer to government speech. Just for my edification, what's the constitutional basis for government speech?
There you go. See, that is a key question. And it figures it would either be Alito or Thomas who would bring that up, right? Again, and it leads you towards the anarchist argument, because there is no ethical way that one can argue that government speech can be supported. It's just not, because it's all based on coercion. And, of course, this idea of compulsion versus trying to convince people of something. The state has all compulsion powers under Section 230, because by removing the protection, that is it's offering a threat. So it's going to push people a certain way. And, of course, we saw an overt statement by Biden to use antitrust against these guys. Let's continue.
Has said, I think that the government is entitled to speak for itself. It's not a right that comes from the First Amendment. It's a feature of our constitutional democracy. As the court has said, the government couldn't function if it couldn't express points of view. In Walker, the court explained, for example, that the government has to be able to run a vaccination campaign at times of public health crisis. I think that's a major part of what was going on here.
So again, this shows you the complete unworkability of the state. Again, that's, it's one of the reasons, just logically, functionally, it's impossible to run the state without stepping on somebody's toes. It's just the way it is. It's axiomatic, right?
It hasn't located it in any specific constitutional provision. It's just part of democratic governance.
Can you explain to me what exactly
Brown, Jack.
Is the...
This might be Sotomayor. Sorry, I'm jumping the gun here.
...function doing? Meaning, how is it affecting your speech, the government's speech? I mean, there's a lot of defense.
So she wants to know, how is the injunction affecting your speech? I'll go back just a second because I stepped on her amazingly well-rehearsed and well-researched lines.
What exactly is the injunction doing? Meaning, how is it affecting your speech, the government's speech? I mean, there's a lot of defendants.
Yep.
There's a lot of agencies. I know that our case law says an injunction just can't tell you to violate the law. And so this injunction might have that problem inherent in it. But the Fifth Circuit injunction is what's before us, correct?
Correct.
And it says to encourage or significantly to coerce, that's a legal term.
Yep.
or significant encouragement, and you're questioning whether what the meaning of significant encouragement is. And I'm not sure I know exactly what the Fifth Circuit meant, but we can figure that out. So let's just use to coerce social media companies to remove, delete, suppress, or reduce, including through altering their algorithms, posted social media content containing protected speech. How is that harmful to the government? I want some specifics.
I'm happy to do that. I'll say first, just to be clear, because this court has stayed the injunction, fortunately, it's not harming the government now. But there were times when we were getting... Exactly, right. So I think the problem with that, we don't say that the government can coerce private speakers. That is prohibited by the First Amendment. But the problem with the Fifth Circuit's injunction saying don't coerce or significantly encourage is that it comes at the end of 80 pages of legal analysis holding that the government had done those things by, for example, when the FBI would send communications to the platforms saying, for your information, it is come to our attention that the following URLs or email addresses or other selectors are being used by malign foreign actors like Russian intelligence operatives to spread.
So right there, I wanted to make sure that I paused it right there because this is an excellent example of this guy, Brian Fletcher. And I saw some great comments over, I think Fregan was putting some, yeah, great comments over at Rumble. This guy, Brian Fletcher, is not just arguing to defend previous actions by the Biden administration or by members of the Trump administration that Trump just magically somehow couldn't control, right? The Fletcher statement here, starting to get into the Russia stuff, is to continue to promote the canard that there was some national security thing and that the Russian so-called interference or propaganda thing was a real thing. That it really was having an effect and was a national security issue, and that the feds had to inform these folks who ran their social media sites because it was just so extremely dangerous. Again, it's laughable. It's so obtuse and so ridiculous, but they're still pushing it. Even inside the halls of the Supreme Court, this guy knows that people are going to be looking at his words and he wants it on record. That's how dangerous these people are. He knows that even in the arguments, he can put in that little bit of a lie about that additional subject to reinforce his argument that it's important for national security, but also to perpetuate the falsehood that there was some national security issue. So he's got two prongs going. It's amazing. And you're going to see the same sort of thing from Ketanji Brown Jackson, right? And again, we know that they did threaten coercion. But the enticement part of it is always there with Section 230. And in a way, it's a form of coercion, because if they remove the so-called protections, then those online platforms can be sued for defamation if somebody using it hurts somebody else with some false statement, or for like pornography or something like that if a state wants to go after the social media platform or the ISP. We'll return with more Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live.
What if you could cut your heating bills this winter with your existing wood-burning fireplace and not spend thousands doing it? You can with Great Wall of Fire Fireplace Grates. Our U.S.-patented, made-in-America Wall of Fire Grates increase fireplace efficiency, eliminate fireplace smoke problems, and come with a 30-day money-back guarantee. See our grates in action and get free shipping from walloffire.com or call 800-274-7364. Fireplace heat without fireplace smoke. Walloffire.com.
Are you a business owner? Are you confused by the complexity of the tax laws? We can help. I'm Dan Pilla, and I've been helping business owners solve tax problems for over 40 years. My book, The Small Business Tax Guide, shows proven ways to avoid all the common business tax problems. Don't risk your business. Go to danpilla.com to order your copy. That's danpilla.com. Order now and get a free 15-minute call directly with me, a $99 value. Go to danpilla.com. That's danpilla.com.
USA News Update. The University of Missouri student who went missing in Nashville has been discovered in a Nashville river. Authorities confirmed Friday morning that the body found in the Cumberland River is indeed Riley Strains. The 22-year-old had last been seen on March 8th when he was escorted out of Luke Bryan's downtown Nashville bar. Police noted no signs of foul play or trauma on the body. A Gaza ceasefire resolution that was backed by the U.S. has been rejected following a vote at the U.N. Security Council Friday. Both Russia and China opposed the resolution, which cautioned against an Israeli military operation in Rafah and strongly denounced restrictions hindering aid access to the Gaza Strip. Kate, the Princess of Wales, revealed in a video message Friday that she has been diagnosed with cancer. She also mentioned being in the early stages of chemotherapy treatment. John Schaefer, USA News.
Wellness and self-care doesn't have to be complicated. So keep it simple and take good care of yourself with Sunny Bay heating pads. Our heating pads soothe pains in the neck, back, and shoulders while relaxing muscles and increasing blood circulation. Sunny Bay heating pads have always been made in the USA and hand-filled to perfection with the highest quality materials. Sunny Bay heating pads are the perfect wellness gift for loved ones or yourself. See all of our high-quality products at sunny-bay.com, including heated body pads, neck pillows, heated neck and body wraps, and our stress-reducing lavender line. They're all affordable, durable, and in stock now and ready for immediate shipping direct from sunny-bay.com. Read our trusted, authentic, and real reviews at sunny-bay.com or just search for Sunny Bay Heating Pad. To your good health and wellness from Sunny Bay.
No matter how large or small your digging project may be, no matter how urban or rural, you must always call 811 before any digging project. 811 is our national one-call number, alerting your local utility companies to come out and mark any lines they have near your dig site. So before you do this or this, make sure you do this. For digging projects big or small, make the call to 811, brought to you by Common Ground Alliance.
I need a copy of my tax return. How do I get one?
If you don't have a copy of your original tax return, you can get a transcript of your tax return for free from the IRS. A transcript shows most line items from your return, which is usually all you need. You can order a transcript of any return filed within the past 3 years, including forms 1040, 1040A, and 1040EZ. All you need to do is go to irs.gov/transcript to order your transcript today.
Appreciate what we do? Help us advertise, market, and promote for just $5 a month at amp.freetalklive.com. Free Talk Live.
We return at Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. You can find Liberty Conspiracy Live every Monday through Friday on Rockfin, Rumble, and my Twitter /X feed. That's at Gard Goldsmith, G-A-R-D Goldsmith. And please feel free to check out the Gardner Goldsmith Substack, where you'll find lots of news and information, the Sunday News Assembly with 20 stories pertaining to Liberty, at least 20, plus video links, and of course, contextual information to help get to the roots of things. And I want to continue with our conversation looking into the oral arguments about the Murthy v. Missouri Supreme Court case. And in this case, we're investigating some of the context from decades ago about what might have been a precedent where the state of Rhode Island tried to stop certain books being published by Bantam Books within the state of Rhode Island. That was part of the discussion inside the Supreme Court. It's a minor part, but it is interesting and it is kind of important to check out before we get into some of the crazy statements from some of the Supreme Court justices and other statements that actually might comport a little bit more to their oaths to their Constitution. We'll check it all out and look at deeper lessons of freedom right here on Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. Thanks for listening, everyone. But the enticement part of it is always there with Section 230. And in a way, it's a form of coercion, because if they remove the so-called protections, then those online platforms can be sued for defamation if somebody using it hurts somebody else with some false statement, or for like pornography or something like that if a state wants to go after the social media platform or the ISP, right? Section 230 says if you conform to what the government says is okay, then you're going to have the carrot. Everything's okay. Well, hiding behind that is an even bigger monster of the existence of the FCC, which claims the power to do this,
And hiding behind even that is the Constitution itself, which grants the Congress the power to be able to block certain types of lawsuits getting into federal courts going across state lines. So the anarchist argument becomes extremely strong here, because Section 230 actually has two facets of it. One is the government deciding what type of speech is okay and curated in good faith. And then the other is the capacity of the federal government to block interstate lawsuits inside the federal courts. So let's say hypothetically you only had a social media website that only operated in your state, right? If there were a lawsuit on that, unless there was some challenge that, you know, the case didn't go properly and they were going to, you know, appeal that to the federal level on, you know, 14th Amendment grounds or something like that, or 5th or 6th or 8th Amendment grounds, that would just be pertain to the states. There would be no cross state lawsuit. Like we mentioned, you know, when they had the rightful use and carry of firearms act that they put forward, you know, what was it 15, 20 years ago or something like that? The lawful use of firearms act, which prevented litigation, tortious claims against gun makers if somebody used a gun, it worked properly, but if they used it to kill somebody. You know, it didn't malfunction, right? Well, the Congress said, no, that's a frivolous lawsuit. We're not even going to allow those interstate. But if you were inside a state and the gun maker were in that state, you could still sue because it's not interstate. It's intrastate. So that's the difference between the federal court system and the circuit, you know, the federal district courts, federal appellate courts and stuff like that. Anything above a state Supreme Court and below the federal Supreme Court, the federal government can create the court system and then decide what cases can go into that court system. So in this case, under Section 230, they were preventing suits against the multi-state use ISPs or social media sites that were going in all these different states from one state to another. They were going to prevent those types of things for defamation and the states bringing some sort of action against the people who ran it. So they have that capacity. And that's actually an enticement and a threat at the same time. And so this is the problem that we see here, because the Biden administration, even if you weren't concentrating on the fact that the Biden administration, Joe Biden himself, vocally said he would use antitrust against these companies if they didn't start to remove content that the government said was dangerous, whether it's about Russia or COVID or the jabs or whatever, right? Now it's going to be about, you know, Israel or whatever it might be, right? And they want to continue to do it despite this injunction. The thing that's hiding behind all that is two-pronged. The FCC, which is unconstitutional, and that Section 230 first half, which gives legal immunity if you go by the government's game. And this is where the threat lies. We're going to remove your protection. That's a threat. Right? So we'll continue. Here we go. Here's more from wonderful Mr. Fletcher.
In the platforms saying, for your information, it has come to our attention
that
the following
year. I went back a little bit, by the way. I went back a little. I'm going to go back just a little bit more here. Here we go.
For example, when the FBI would send communications to the platforms saying, for your information, it has come to our attention that the following URLs or email addresses or other selectors are being used by malign foreign actors like Russian intelligence operatives to spread disinformation on your platforms. Do with it what you will. That, the circuit held, is coercive because the FBI is a powerful law enforcement agency. And I think if the injunction were put in place, the FBI would have to think very hard about whether it could continue to do that. Similarly, I think both the Fifth Circuit and my friends have really said that the crux of what they claim was coercion here was what happened in July of 2021 when the Surgeon General, the White House Press Secretary, and the President himself made statements criticizing the platform's practices on misinformation and false statements about COVID vaccines and calling on them to do better. I think it's really troubling, the idea that those sorts of classic bully pulpit exhortations, public statements urging actors to behave in different ways, might be deemed to violate the First Amendment. And I think
Again, he is fudging the historical record. It wasn't, we exhort you to do better. It was, we plead for you to do better or else. That's what it was. That's what it was. There's no denying this. And there's the added corruption that they were literally funding this, not only by giving Twitter $3.5 million, but also through the Portman Murphy so-called Countering Foreign Propaganda Act with things like NewsGuard. You're talking to a guy who worked for hours trying to answer NewsGuard emails. This case pertains to me and probably you if you're trying to post some truth about the so-called pandemic. It's amazing. People's lives were harmed or lost because of the actions of these state operators. They are offensive, absolutely, utterly, historically dark, totally evil.
Injunction were to go into effect, and the president or his senior advisors, the president isn't enjoined, but if his senior advisors, the press secretary or someone else, wanted to talk to the public about other problems, like the circulation of anti-Semitic or Islamophobic content on social media platforms, or the effects they might be having on children's mental health, or national security issues like the anti-Semitic Osama bin Laden letter that was trending on TikTok at the end.
There you go. He's going right into it. It's all propagandistic. Was the Osama bin Laden letter anti-Semitic or anti-Western and Zionist aggression? I think we know. I think it's very clear. And, of course, it's amazing. He's involved with propagating falsehoods even while he's there, not just to defend the past, but to promote things today, now, in the current argumentation. It's just mind-blowing. I couldn't believe it while I was sitting there. I was having some carrots at lunch. I'm like, holy smoke. Wow.
Last year, we referenced towards the end of our brief. I think all of those things could be done only under the shadow of the injunction, and that comes around to the other point that you made, which is that this injunction, especially read in light of the opinion that comes before it, is extremely vague. I think.
Okay, so get this. This guy is arguing, this guy is arguing those very, very important messages that they'd like to get out can only be done now under the threat of this injunction. Well, what were they doing to us? What were they doing to the ISPs and the social media or social media companies except putting out a threat that if you don't conform to a particular order or message, it's an implied order, you're going to get slammed. He's making the same argument for the government that actually could apply to us under all these standards that they were pushing. This fatuous dude named Fletcher literally is complaining because the government might be prevented from putting out its message. It's like, dude, do you have any concept of what a massive hypocrite you look like? I mean, this is like I mentioned, this is like not Mount Olympus. This is Olympus Mons on Mars, that big a mountain of hypocrisy. It's incredible. Unbelievable. I wonder how much this dude gets paid.
Having that sort of vague injunction with these contestable legal terms that have been interpreted very broadly as applied to past conduct, hanging over the heads of all of these government officials doing all of these things, is a real problem. And I think especially so when you're talking about entering such an injunction at the behest of two states and five individual social media users whose main complaints are about the moderation of posts about COVID-19 many years ago that they haven't really even shown were traceable to the government to begin with, we think. And we certainly don't think that they've shown that they face the sort of imminent threat of future injury that's required to satisfy Article 3.
Mr. Fletcher, let me follow up on that. If even one of the plaintiffs has standing, then we're required to get to the merits. So let me ask you about Ms. Hines. And as you just mentioned, she must have faced an imminent threat of future injury at the time when the complaint was filed, and that injury must be traceable to the actions of the government. So in the first part of that, imminent threat of future injury, her Facebook personal account was restricted at the time when the complaint was filed. So why isn't that sufficient to show an imminent threat of future injury?
We're not disputing that when the private platforms moderated the plaintiffs' pages or their posts, that's an injury in some sense. We haven't disputed that they suffered that injury. We've disputed the traceability question and then the redressability question.
Right. So on traceability is basically a question of causation, right?
Agreed.
All right. Both the district court found that the injury was traceable to the government's actions. And the Fifth Circuit accepted that finding, reviewed it, and accepted it. So that's two lower courts. We don't usually reverse findings of fact that have been endorsed by two lower courts, and you haven't attempted to show that it was clear that that finding is clearly erroneous.
So respectfully, Justice Alito, I disagree with that. I think that the Fifth Circuit and the District Court applied too loose a notion of traceability. They didn't try to say this post or any action against Ms. Hines was traceable to any action by the government. They did what the Red Brief calls a bird's eye view of traceability. They said the government is talking to the platforms a lot. The platforms are doing moderation. And so we'll just assume that all of that moderation is traceable to the government.
Well, do you think that...
All right, so I just want to pause it there, because anybody who understands the way that the platforms operate understands that the operation is based on algorithms that they create, which will then target particular types of speech. So if she has a type of speech that matches certain types of speech that the government told these platforms was dangerous types of speech, and it's traceable, of course, to the threat that they'll remove Section 230 protection, you get traceability right there. And you don't, it's just ridiculous. So this guy's arguing, again, as I mentioned, because it's done to a lot of people, you can't trace it to a specific person. But the policy of doing it to a lot of people then hoovers up her specific post because it has a content in it that they designed to go after that specific wording. Those things, those keywords. The specificity is inherent in the AI programming. That's the point. It could be anybody. This is what they don't get. They don't understand. When they generalize these things, it's a generalization that hits individuals, period. They don't get it. Amazing. Alito nails this. This is excellent.
It's necessary to identify a single government action and then trace it to a single consequence. Do you think that's required?
No, but I think you have to trace some government action to some consequence that befell you. And maybe I could just be specific about this, because we challenged this in our opening brief, and the red brief comes back at pages 19 to 21 and offers up what I take to be their best examples of traceable harm. And I invite you to go look at the pages of the record that they're citing, because often what you find is that they're citing moderation of their content that happened either before the challenged government actions to which they're referring or long after.
All right, I have looked at that. On the issue of causation, under Malhealthy, are they required to show anything more than the government's action was a motivating factor?
I don't know the answer to that in all cases, and I'm reluctant to make sort of broad statements about what the traceability requirement demands in different circumstances. I will say here, we're not disputing that. We're saying that they haven't shown any causal connection between the...
It has no effect whatsoever.
Right. And the
both the lower courts were wrong on that.
I think they were, because, again, they did this blunderbuss approach where they said the government is talking to the platforms about moderation, and the platforms are moderating content, but the platforms were moderating this content long before the government was talking to them. They had powerful business incentives to do the same thing. The acts of moderation.
Okay, again, it's just so important, so important. Why do you think, as we all know, why were the platforms moderating that content? Twofold, philosophically, and also because they knew the threat of Section 230 was there, and that if they stepped out of bounds, they'd be in trouble. It's very, very clear. We knew this from the start as they started to promote these lines. Suddenly we started to see, as the government started to push these lines, so followed social media. The government came up with these lines first. The CDC argued these things. Fauci argued these things. And then the social media sites followed after that. They didn't come up with this on their own. They didn't hire scientists to say, oh, let's look into this information. No, they went with what was the so-called science.
Consistent with the platform's own policies. And this is, I think, another telling fact. In those red brief examples that we talked about on pages 19 to 21, some of them involved platforms like LinkedIn that wasn't even the subject of the challenged White House and Surgeon General's office communications with the platforms.
Do you think that there are any factual findings with respect to standing that we are required to give clear error review to?
I think findings of historical fact.
That was Elena Kagan, by the way, if you're just listening.
We're not
not fighting that. So the idea that pieces of content were moderated, that the government made certain statements, and if there had been findings that said Facebook deleted this post because of these communications by the government, that would be a factual finding, a historical fact, but there just aren't such findings.
Right. I mean, that's what I was really getting at. Are there findings that you concede, you know, that one, you have to apply clear error of you do. That one, you have to do the same.
Yeah, we do. And I can't give you a list because there's a lot of facts in this case, but we agree historical factual findings count. What we say don't count are findings that are really characterizations, which is a lot of what my friends are relying on, findings that are about the application of law to facts, which in this constitutional realm we think get de novo review, and then findings that are premised on erroneous legal standards.
So, Mr. Fletcher, I just want to nail down what your views are on the legal standards for untraceability.
This is Neil Gorsuch speaking, if you're just listening. Now he's talking about traceability here.
You're not disputing that a motivating factor is enough.
Well, we haven't made that argument here. That's right.
Okay. And then on redressability, what's your view of the legal standard the court should be applying?
I think, again, it has to be some showing that I think likely to redress the injury is the standard from Lujan. So it doesn't have to be certain, but you have to make some showing that an injunction against the government will stop the platforms from doing it.
In Massachusetts versus EPA, we've said likely to some extent. Does that strike you as correct?
I think in the context of Mass versus EPA, maybe where you're talking about a problem of degrees, you know, here where the concern is, are the platforms going to moderate my posts or not, and are they going to do it because of the government or not, and will an injunction against the government stop Facebook? And
to some degree, is that an acceptable standard to the government?
I guess I just
want to know what my yardstick that I'm supposed to measure these allegations against, and there's not a lot in your brief about it. So I take likely from Lujan.
Yeah.
I take to some extent from Massachusetts versus EPA, and I take the statement in Larson that it doesn't have to address every injury.
Agreed.
You agreed with all of that?
Except that to some extent, I think, was there the state's injury was about rising sea levels, and so to some extent means it doesn't have to solve the problem. It has to help it a little bit.
And
this is more discrete acts of content.
Could you agree with that standard, though, that to some extent, if they could show that their injury would be remedied to some extent by an injunction, that would be enough.
Correct. So if they're likely to face moderation on 10 posts and an injunction against the government would make it 8, that's enough.
Okay. And then just flipping back to traceability, I'm sorry, I forgot to ask. Substantial motivating factor obviously means it doesn't have to be proximate cause.
Agreed.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Fletcher, when I read all of the emails exchanged between the White House and other federal officials and Facebook in particular, but also some of the other platforms.
This is Sam Alito.
And I see that the White House and federal officials are repeatedly saying that Facebook and the federal government should be partners. We are on the same team. Officials are demanding answers. I want an answer. I want it right away. When they're unhappy, they curse them out. There are regular meetings. There is constant pestering of Facebook and some of the other platforms, and they want to have regular meetings, and they suggest, why don't you suggest rules that should be applied, and why don't you tell us everything that you're going to do so we can help you and we can look it over. And I thought, wow, I cannot imagine federal officials taking that approach to the print media, our representatives over there. If you did that to them, what do you think the reaction would be? And so I thought, you know, the only reason why this is taking place is because the federal government has got Section 230 and antitrust in its pocket, and it's, to mix my metaphors, and it's got these big clubs available to it. And so it's treating Facebook and these other platforms like their subordinates. Would you do that?
Exactly. And it just, it's stunning to me that anybody who is at all cognizant doesn't go directly to Section 230 and the antitrust threat. Period. They're always behind the whole thing. And you know, it's amazing. So I would love to ask Mr. Fletcher and say, okay, it's not exactly analogous, but if you worked for a company that got bought out, and then the heads of the company said, well, you know, under the old leadership, we had sort of a promise that, you know, you could get, a 2-hour lunch, or, you know, you could keep your job if you continue to do X, Y, or Z. But we're going to change that policy if you don't do this new thing now. Now, people will look at that and say, well, that's a breach of contract. You're messing with me. I had an agreement with these other people, and you're supposed to abide by that agreement, right? Well, under the Constitution, which they foisted on us, we didn't even agree to that. It's very clear what's going on. And under Section 230 of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and even under the unconstitutional antitrust statutes, these guys are preventing threats. And those threats are having an effect overall on the population, on the overall universe of different social media sites, of the populations there. Inside those universes, they are populated by specific individuals. So if these sites are coming up with universal policies that they're applying through algorithms, it's clearly traceable to any individual who might use that and be seeing something that says, oh, that terminology just had me removed. Very easily. Somebody had to remove them, and it was for that language. That, again, is, I think, the deeper approach than even just citing Joe Biden threatening antitrust. But Alito nails it because he mentions Section 230. That is exactly right. And I think anybody who goes to law school, if they're not familiar with this and they're talking about telecommunications, for goodness sake, it's stunning to me. If I had been sitting there on the benches listening to this, I would have gotten up and freaked out. It's insane.
To the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Associated Press.
Let's go back. He's like, if they had said this to a newspaper, would anybody have accepted that? Not a chance, right?
Because the federal government has got Section 230 and antitrust in its pocket, and it's, to mix my metaphors, and it's got these big clubs available to it. And so it's treating Facebook and these other platforms like they're subordinates.
We'll return with more Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live, continuing our investigation into the oral arguments in the Murthy v. Missouri free speech case. Find us every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. live on Rockfin, Rumble, and my Twitter/X at Guard Goldsmith.
If you're concerned about the power grid and want to generate your own supply of off-grid electricity, this will be the most important message you'll hear this year. Here's why. We now have a small number of solar generators back in stock. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving backup power when you need it most. And unlike gas generators, solar generators run quietly, emit no dangerous fumes, and produce an endless supply of free electricity from the sun. Whether it's wildfires, dangerous weather, power grid issues, or just getting off the grid, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. Even better, all this week, radio listeners get over $700 in free off-the-grid bonuses, too. Go to mysolarbackup.com to learn more and check availability. That's mysolarbackup.com. Look for the free report, Crisis Cooling, how to make absolutely sure your meat, milk, and medicines stay safe and cool in any power outage. Yours free at mysolarbackup.com.
Do you know someone with a drug or alcohol problem? Get help now. Insurance may cover everything. Stop the drug and alcohol nightmare. Call 800-284-0523. Learn how through the Family Medical Leave Act, you can leave your job without losing your job. Locations everywhere. Get immediate help for drug and alcohol problems. Call now. 800-284-0523. 800-284-0523.
Complement your health with hemp-derived cannabinoid oil. We've always believed that the closer to Earth, the better it is for our bodies. Our hemp-derived cannabinoid oil is phytocannabinoid-rich, full-spectrum, and organically grown. Finally, hemp made easy, clean, and effective. GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203. That's right, we cut through the red tape. It's now available at GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203.